I believe we are joined now by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
How are you doing? We're really glad you could join us. I should tell people, go to gowans.wordpress.com for Stephen's views on all these matters that we're going to talk about today. And the first one is this amazing situation where one in the morning we're talking about whether or not there will be a nuclear war, and then in the afternoon we're talking about whether the president has struck the right note in talking about matters in Virginia. But the war matter, I suppose, and I hope you agree, is kind of important. Give us your assessment of why we're experiencing this now, and is it in is it different than our almost annual problems coming from the U.S. with Korea?
Is what we're experiencing now unusual or is different? I think it's different in the sense that the United States recognizes that North Korea is on the cusp of developing a nuclear weapons program that will allow itself to pose the threat of retaliation to the United States. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the North Koreans having a nuclear weapons arsenal, but there's still the question of whether they can reliably deliver a warhead and whether they've developed the technology to enable warheads to re-enter the atmosphere without burning up. But it seems like they're on the cusp of developing that. And so there's a danger that the United States could intervene to stop them from reaching that final stage. And certainly they've undertaken a number of efforts to do so, one of which is a cyber warfare program to sabotage and undermine the missile program.
So the reason that, from the point of view of Washington, that the situation might be alarming is that it appears North Korea is able to defend itself. Is that right?
No, exactly. And, you know, the United States was actually the first to introduce nuclear weapons into the Korean Peninsula, although the United States claims that it's all for a nuclear weapons-free Korea. But the United States has always intended and made clear to the North Koreans that if they ever invaded the South, that is, took measures to reunify the country, which had been divided by the United States, they would use nuclear weapons to annihilate the North Koreans, and they've always been quite open about this intention to essentially commit genocide. They've talked variously about the country would no longer exist and will turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette and so on. I mean,
yeah, by the way, that language is not original with Trump, is it? I mean, this stuff about how Trump is, it's his rhetoric that it bothers people. There's been some blood-curdling rhetoric since the Korean War.
Yes, and I mean, the United States did turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette during the Korean War deliberately. I mean, they burned the country to the ground using napalm and incendiaries, completely leveling the place. And they make clear that they intend to do that again if the North Koreans ever decide to take it upon themselves to do what they might consider their patriotic duty to reunify their country. But now things have changed, or we're on the cusp of a change where the North Koreans could do so, could actually launch an invasion of the South and have a way of staying the U.S. hand by threatening to retaliate if the United States uses nuclear weapons. But the United States has had this long program of trying to intimidate the North Koreans through military means, quite a number of means, one of which is the incessant war games that just go on and on and on. In fact, we've had large-scale war games already this year, and they're gearing up to do more month. And the North Koreans argue that the war games, I mean, to use their words, are plugging North Korea into an arms race through ceaseless war drills and an arms buildup. And this is a bid to throw hurdles in North Korea's efforts to develop its economy and improve the standard of living of its people by forcing the country to invest a considerable amount of its limited resources in the military. I mean, a number of American historians and academics always point out that, and others in the media point out that North Korea is a garrison state and it's one of the most highly militarized states. And this is said...
And therefore it's sovereign.
But this is said in disapproving tones, but never point out why it is that North Korea is such a garrison state and a militarized state. It's because it's forced to be so as a means of surviving. But what I found interesting in the latest events is that North Korea has been portrayed as the provocateur in this case, as provoking Trump's threats. Or certainly that's the way in which Trump portrayed them. There was the talk about the North Koreans saying that they would launch ICBMs toward Guam. But I think one of the things that wasn't explained very well was that the North Koreans were replying to McMaster, the national security advisor, who had made it plain that the United States is or has drawn up plans for preventive war. Mm-hmm. And the prevention in this case is not to prevent North Korea from attacking the United States, but to prevent North Korea from finally developing its nuclear weapons capability. And so the North Koreans, if you read their press and their statement, essentially said, well, if you can draw plans for a preventive war, we can do the same. Mm-hmm. And so what we're going to prevent you from doing is carrying out a nuclear attack on us, because what you keep doing is you use Guam, and I mean Guam has been presented as simply an island sitting somewhere in the South Pacific minding its own business. It's, you know, the site of Anderson Air Force Base, which is a strategic bomber base. And the United States, since 1993, has been sending strategic bombers from Anderson Air Force Base over the Korean Peninsula. And they've been doing that frequently in the last few days. In fact, or not last few months, in July, early July, they sent two B-1B bombers from the Anderson Air Force Base in Guam to the Korean Peninsula to practice attack capabilities with South Korean fighters. This also involved U.S. F-16 fighters as well as fighter planes from the Japanese Air Force.
The Japanese Air Force.
Yes, and during the drill, these bombers flew from Anderson Air Force Base in Guam to the Korean Peninsula, where they released inert weapons on an Air Force training range in South Korea, which was about 90 miles south of the demilitarized zone. And they were joined by South Korean and U.S. F-16 jet fighters. Then they flew with Japanese F-2 jet fighters over the East China Sea before returning to Guam. Now, what the North Koreans said was, well, what we'll do is we'll send some ICBMs toward Guam. We're developing a plan. They're using the same language that McMaster used. We're developing a plan, and we're going to consider it. So they said, we're developing a plan, and we're going to consider it. And the plan is we're going to send four ICBMs hurtling toward Guam, but they'll land outside of the territorial waters. Not going to attack Guam, but we're going to,
just practice.
Yes. we're going to consider this anyway. And we're not saying that we're going to do it, but it's just something we have on the planning board. And so they're simply mimicking the Americans who keep saying the same thing,
Well, that's where, I guess, in terms of our people who don't want to die in a nuclear war, we do have a problem in cities like Toronto, New York, Los Angeles. They didn't hear what you just told us, right? I mean, the Los Angeles Times did not share that. Even the almost the bemused approach that the North Koreans were taking. Instead, they turned it into a Hollywood caricature of President Kim.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, but this is a, we don't have a political conversation here that I'm aware of. My understanding is that Chrystia Freeland, our very foreign minister, has said, you know, the problem is North Korea. And we, by the way, as the foreign ministry says, Canada's under the American umbrella, which frankly doesn't mean we don't actually have any say at all.
No.
It's probably best we say nothing. I'm glad we're talking to you in Ottawa, but from a government point of view, apparently silence is the best rule.
It's been pointed out recently that when the Chinese acquired a nuclear weapons capability, the United States made the same kind of noises, about the dangers that have been presented to the world. And the problem was with China, and the United States learned to live with that. Simply because someone has, or a country has, nuclear weapons doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to use them against you.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others within Washington who have been pointing out that Washington can live with a nuclear-armed Korea in the same way they've lived with a nuclear-armed China and a nuclear-armed Russia. And, you know, one of the arguments that's been raised is, well, the North Koreans can't have nuclear arms because the leader is crazy. And yet there are people in the U.S. administration as well who are saying that, well, that's not the case. The director of national intelligence, has said that Kim Jong-un is coolly rational, mm-hmm. as have members of the security establishment from the Obama administration. For example, Susan Rice, who was the national security advisor.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about in your writing on the Korean issue, you pointed out something that I wonder how this works into this. The thing called THAAD, or THADD, the Americans decided on their, they made the decision, they're going to put these special kind of missiles in South Korea. But it was not just North Korea that reacted. China said those weapons represented a threat to them. So again, I don't think the Canadian population, certainly not the Americans, are having it explained to them, what is it about that that's particularly dangerous? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and the THAAD that's being deployed in South Korea is being presented as a defense against North Korean missiles. And many people have pointed out for various reasons why that argument is not compelling at all, that it doesn't really provide any kind of defense against North Korean missiles. And that the intention, as Russians and the Chinese point out, is that the THAAD anti-missile system allows the United States to peer deeply into China and to track missiles or ICBMs that could come from China. So it would provide the United States with a first strike capability because it may be able to knock out China's ICBMs. One of the best arguments I saw recently for why we shouldn't believe that THAAD has anything to do with North Korea's missiles is that THAAD provides no protection for Seoul, which, I mean, Seoul accounts for half of the South Korean population. Mm-hmm. So any kind of effective missile defense system would cover Seoul. In fact, there are other missile defense systems that are installed in South Korea,
mm-hmm.
That would be far more effective. The South Koreans are not going to launch a nuclear-tipped missile at South Korea. I mean, that would be self-destructive and would undermine themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's somewhat the scary part, isn't it? I mean, that, for example, something as important as missile would be perceived rightly by China as probably directed at them, they have to make then certain calculations and they have to say some things, which then here, because we're not informed of the true nature of the operation, People are nonplussed when China or Russia says something about them. And then it's just treated as, well, once again, you know, Russian expansionism or communist expansionism, instead of just a rational discussion.
Okay. Right. I should have pointed out, too, but that is also being used to put pressure on China with respect to North Korea. And the Americans have said this. So you don't like THAAD? Well, if you do something about North Korea, maybe we can see our way to removing it. In the same way that Trump just recently said, well, you know, I have a problem with trade, but maybe I wouldn't have so much of a problem if you did something about North Korea.
Yeah. By the way, that's another aspect of this, I suppose. There is a kind of conceit that is built into the way the U.S. addresses questions, because they seem to want to do two things. Well, one, they always say they're of course the virtue personified, but the other is they're number one, their own population has to be continually reminded that they're dictating, right? That it looks good to be dictating.
Okay. For some, I guess it does, yeah.
I mean, in terms of how they try to – it's a kind of ugly phenomenon. But all these – you get in trouble as a U.S. leader, ask Jimmy Carter, and if you're not hurting somebody and showing the world that you can do that, and that's the part should ultimately be very worrying to people, going with that, this seems to be the tipping point with U.S. and China and Russia. Can they do what you've been saying in this interview? They could live with these weapons. They could live with the missiles. All you have to do, and I guess we should emphasize that, is speak directly and respectfully to the other party and then solve it. We haven't addressed that, but I'd ask you that. Isn't it true that all that's missing here for rational relationship is a peace treaty between the United States and North Korea?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that North Korea is a garrison society is because there isn't a peace treaty and the U.S. refuses to sign one despite, you know, the urging of North Korea over and over and over. Mm-hmm. Teaching the Americans to finally resolve this issue and sign a treaty of peace, and the Americans saying, oh, we don't do things like that. Mm-hmm. I think it was Colin Powell who said, we don't sign peace treaties, things of that nature.
Why? By the way, have they ever explained, I hate to take you over the same ground, but I don't think our listeners hear this enough. Why is the United States, who arrived in South Korea at the end of the Second World War, why is it still there? Why are there more than 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea?
Yeah. I mean the U.S. strategy ultimately is to bring about the collapse of North Korea. And so that's the reason why there's this incessant pressure on North Korea militarily. And that's the reason why they have no intention of ever arriving at a peace treaty, because they don't want to relieve the pressure. I should also point out that one of the reasons the North Koreans have acquired a nuclear weapons capability is because it allows them to relieve that pressure as well. We talk about the immense amount of money they invest in their military. Well, if they have a credible nuclear deterrent, they don't have to invest as much in conventional military means to defend themselves. So this is also, the development of the nuclear weapons is also a means of trying to...
This is turning into a good title, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. I feel like Dr. Strangelove. One other point about that, I'm impressed that the leadership in North Korea actually makes that their programmatic position. They don't say, well, look, we're building the most advanced society and we're going to do all these things. They say, we are actually going to go on short rations here in order to defend the country and the people appreciate that. I would think, by the way, that's probably appreciated on the whole peninsula.
Yes, it is. To the extent that it's understood in the South.
Yeah. Yeah.
And many people do, but not everyone does in the South.
World War II, people said, we will go on rations, but we will win this war.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you end up respecting those who made such a tough decision rather than, oh, I'm going to make sure you have all the butter and bread you could possibly want. Meanwhile, I'm going to have this bomb. They say, in order to have it, we're going to have to do some things that are going to be tough, but we will do that.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, one of the top historians of modern Korea, Bruce Cummings, has pointed out frequently that this attempt to bring about the collapse of North Korea is a complete failure. The United States continues to pursue that policy, and it simply makes North Koreans more determined to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, all of their policy, going back to the Clinton administration, is earlier than that, is predicated on the whole idea that the collapse of North Korea is coming soon, any day now. It doesn't happen, in fact.
Yes.
Contrary, North Korea's economy is better than it's ever been since the collapse of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, when it lost access to a lot of its markets and suffered an economic crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, by the way, isn't that the history of revolutions, where others oppose them, and 15, 20 years down the road, they say, we want to thank you for your antagonism and brutality, because our people have learned all about you, and they've also learned to run things themselves, so they don't... We're glad of that experience. I got to switch gears and ask you one question about Venezuela, because Trump also thinks he might invade for the good of the Venezuelans. And the Globe and Mail said the other day it's our duty to bother the Venezuelans. They're experiencing a lot of trouble, and some people call themselves progressives have actually tried to kind of nip at the ankles of Venezuela as it fights off the U.S. What do you make of that? Are you wavering at all? What do you think about the Venezuela matter and the intimidation they're experiencing?
No, I'm not wavering at all. I think the New York Times finally pointed out exactly what this is all about. And they said very simply, the Constituent Assembly will be able to take one piece of work left unfinished by Mr. Chavez, creating a more socialist constitution. Many people don't like socialism. Many people, the elite, the United States certainly doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. allies don't. The economic elite doesn't. So, and this is they're attempting to make Venezuela ungovernable, mm-hmm. to ensure that this movement towards socialism is blocked.
Yeah.
It's also, I read today that Maduro is now one of four heads of state subject to direct sanctions by Washington, including Bashar al-Assad, Kim Jong-un, and Robert Mugabe.
Aha.
All of whom are people who kind of resist the U.S. international dictatorship.
Wow. Stephen Gowans, you put it right on the – hit it right on the nose. Go to that blog, What's Left, gowans.wordpress.com. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. And I want to thank Francois and Carol, and we'll see you next week.